Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Big Sell when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? And that bonds are the exact opposite to private property? And public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights? And that permits are the exact opposite to private business? Now, why is it that we see small businesses being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you and I do to protect our lives, our liberties, and our properties from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out our substance? Well, you know, there's a lot that we can do, and the first step is to inform ourselves as to the legal alternatives that we have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this thing called private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. Let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's a secret. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. Just call us direct, 417-273-4967, and ask for one. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, you can also go to our webpage, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. Hey, we're talking about the Big Sell, and I pointed out to you that government, business, industry, pharmaceuticals, all these big multinational corporations are selling us something. Congress right now and the president are selling us on the idea of a stimulus package. Now, does it work? No. About 99% of the time, none of these Big Sell operations actually work. Well, they don't work for you and I down here at the bottom level. You know, Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives down here, we pay for all of this. We don't get the goods that go with it. Now, take this big stimulus package over here. I was watching the Lehrer NewsHour the other night, and I noticed the president said, hey, it's time to quit talking, it's time to act. Now, the Republicans are sitting over saying, are you really sure you want to spend $1 trillion on this? And the president says, yep, we want to spend $1 trillion on this. Now, that $1 trillion over there that we're going to spend is to stimulate the economy. And then we're talking about the Republicans said, well, we think that you should lower taxes, and if you lowered taxes, that would put more money into the hands of consumers. And the president said, no, we can't have that. We can't have this tax cut thing over here. We got to have more borrowing so that we can take this money and we can spend it on roads and infrastructure. No, I'm just a plumber, and I'm not an economist. I don't have all these degrees from college, but I got to thinking about that, and they're talking about, well, what's the fastest way to get this $1 trillion worth of stimulus package into the hands of consumers? And I got to mulling that over a little bit, and they're talking and talking, and you know, they're They had these panelists on there, and they're talking about, well, how can we do this? And they're really concerned that the last one, you know, the Bush stimulus program, they sent out $150 billion to you people, sent you checks, and you put them in the bank and saved it. You didn't go out and spend it and stimulate the economy. Now, when we build a bridge over the Mississippi River, or we go out here and we build a freeway or something like that, that money is paid out to these big corporations like Halliburton and KBR and all these outfits. That's the point of this borrow and spend. It doesn't have anything to do with getting this money out to Joe Sixpack. It has to do with Joe Sixpack sending his money to Washington so that we can spend that money on building a bridge by having some multinational corporations, you know, some big outfit, come in here, you know, and build it for us. Now, of course, some of that money is going to get into the economy because you got to hire some guys to build it. I don't deny that. But I got to think about that, and I said, you know, if I wanted to put $1 trillion into the hands of Joe Sixpack, and if I was running the Congress, which I'm not, but if I was running it, I would cut the payroll taxes. I'd pass a bill and I'd say, okay, starting Monday morning at 8 o'clock, payroll taxes are cut in half. And what that would do, Joe, is the next time you get your paycheck, your payroll taxes would be cut in half, and then you take that whatever it is, you know, say you're paying $100 a week in payroll taxes, all of a sudden you got an extra $50 a week, $200 a month, to spend on gasoline or a trip to the beach or a trip to, you know, water skiing or whatever the hell you're doing, you know, paying some bills off or whatever. Now, that isn't going to happen. I'm not sitting here dreaming, you know. The government's not going to do that because that's not the plan. That's not the program. It's not the way the game's been played. So since that's the way the deal's coming down, I got to looking here. I remember I was telling you about the tax policy here in the United States, and it comes, there's a neat publication here called Budget and Tax News, and it's put out by the Heartland Institute. And I told you yesterday about the New Jersey tax hike actually reduces revenues, and it's entitled Reduces Revenues Again. See, the legislature of New Jersey has raised taxes on cigarettes, and then for whatever reason, and the article tells you here's what happened, they were collecting, you know, $50 million a year, and then they raised the tax, and then they collected $45 million a year. Then they did it again. They raised the tax again. They collected $40 million. And what this does is it drives the customer to Pennsylvania or New York or someplace else to buy those cigarettes. Better yet, it brings in the mafia and the smugglers who bring them in from North Carolina and sell them for half price, which puts more people to smoking because there's more teenagers can now afford cigarettes at $2.50 a pack than they can at $5 a pack paying the government tax. And so it's counterproductive. See, that's what the bottom line is. It's counterproductive. So there's an outfit called the Heartland Institute, and they put out a newsletter once a month. Well, it's actually 10 times a year. It's a little less than once a month, and it's $36 a year, and it deals with this thing of taxes. See, I wouldn't have known that. I don't follow that kind of thing. I'm not really interested in New Jersey's cigarette tax. But I am interested in learning why these taxes become regressive. You know, I look at this and I say, what would be the most intelligent tax policy which would raise the most money for government and at the same time promote trade, commerce, business, and industry so that we all work harder to produce more and pay more tax? Which is what everybody wants. It's not what we're getting. That's what everybody wants. Now, here's an article. Let's take a look at this article. It says, the upper Midwest is enjoying a sudden renaissance of economic freedom. I thought, well, it's an interesting article. Let's take a look at it. Why is the upper Midwest enjoying this sudden renaissance of economic freedom? And where is this upper Midwest? And how is this renaissance of economic freedom filtering down to the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives? How does it benefit us guys out here driving trucks and fixing pipes and clearing the sewer drains. How does that benefit us guys? Well, listen to this. In news that has come as something of a surprise to many economy watchers and economists, the South is no longer the United States region offering the most promising trend toward economic freedom. The new champion is the upper Midwest, in places like South Dakota, which tops the latest U.S. Economic Freedom Index issued by the Pacific Research Institute and Forbes magazine. Now, this economic index uses 143 variables that are organized into five sectors: fiscal, regulatory, judicial, government size, and welfare spending. That's the five sectors. To determine just how much of a threat the state government policies pose to the economic freedom of businesses and individuals. Now, the higher a state's taxes, the heavier its regulation, the more activist its judges, the larger its welfare budget, and the more bloated its spending, the less economic freedom its residents have, the report observes. Right? So that makes I can understand that. I can figure that right out. I used to run a company up in Boise, Idaho. And one day, when doing my numbers, you know, this is about the time I learned how to count. I was doing my numbers, you see, and I figured out that I was making about $100,000 a year. And you're sitting there saying, well, my God, Gordon, you know you're doing all right. Yeah, I wasn't complaining, but I noticed that the government was getting $200,000 a year. I noticed that the government was getting twice as much as I did. And they not only didn't do anything, they actually inhibited me and got in my way. And I didn't like that. And it got to the point here in Idaho, well, it was both federal and state, with regulation and so on, regulation and taxes. One day I woke up and I said, I ain't going to take this no more. That was about 1978. I just woke up and I looked around and I said, you know, I'm running a business here that produces $100,000 a month. It employs 30 people. It produces goods that the public wants to buy. They like them. It's adding to the gross domestic product. It pays taxes. And it pays 30 families mortgages and rent every month. It pays 30 families car payments every month. This business, this operation, this enterprise, it supports 31 families, 30 working for me and my family. Small business, we call this. Now, keep in mind that small business employs 65% of all Americans. So if you think that salvation is coming from a big stimulus package headed for J.P. Morgan, Citicorp, and General Electric, and General Motors, I think you should understand here that government, which is now, by the way, hiring people, government employs 10% of the people of America. Big business employs 25%. It's a bunch of people, I don't deny it. But the majority of Americans work for companies that have less than 100 employees. Places like the Olive Garden restaurant. They might have a staff of 20 or 30 people. See, each one of these restaurants and gas stations and 7-Eleven stores and all these businesses that you see out here, they're not employing thousands of people. They're employing a handful of people, 10, 20, 30, 5. Maybe a little business with just one or two. A farmer out here with two hired hands. That's a small business. Now that's where Americans work, and that's where America gets its tax money. Every single American government worker is a tick in a dog's ear. They're a parasite. They produce nothing and consume much. There aren't any government workers out there that are producing any food, fiber, furniture, or useful, productive, meaningful work. None. Zero. Now, they might be doing some nice services for you, like delivering your mail. But they're not producing anything that you need in your life, like an automobile, or potatoes and gravy, or meat, milk, butter, and eggs, or a roof over your head. Now, that's what we all need is food, clothing, and shelter. I don't need a secretary pushing papers at the Department of Transportation. And neither do you. And neither does anybody else. Now, they're there. And they're performing a service, and maybe it makes life better for us. But they're not essential by any stretch of the imagination. And so governments now seem to think that money is the big solution to everything. And if you've got poverty, I've said this before, now think about this for a minute. Let's suppose that we've got some people and they're poor. Well, why don't we just make them all rich? It's simple. All the government has to do is print up $1 million and pass it out, like George Bush did last year in a stimulus package. He sent out $600 to all these people all over America. I didn't get my $600, but I just wanted to let you know that he sent this money out. Well, evidently he wanted to stimulate the economy. Hell, I can do a better job than that. Why don't we print up $1 million and send it out to everybody in the country, and everybody all of a sudden is a millionaire? What do you think is going to happen next? If you want to eliminate poverty, I can tell you how to do that. I'll just print the money up and pass it out. Now everybody's got lots of money. Now they've tested that theory. It's been used more than once around the world. They're testing it right now down in Zimbabwe. And what we find out is that when you've got all this money out here called hyperinflation, it drives all the goods off the shelves. The price of gas, the last time I saw down in Zimbabwe, was $237,000 a gallon. I don't know. I think that's the good news, because the bad news was there wasn't any gasoline available at any price. You couldn't buy gasoline anywhere. None there. Zero. Same thing with food and clothing. They got starvation going on down there. So we tested it in Germany in 1923. We tested it in the United States of America in 1783. It's been tested all around the world. It's never worked for anybody in the past. What in the hell would make you think it's going to work now? But this is what the government's hell-bent on doing. By God, we're going to... Ben Bernanke said, well, to dump money out of helicopters, if that's what necessary. That's why he's called Helicopter Ben. Now, with that little piece of information, let's go back here to South Dakota. What is it that's going on in South Dakota that's helping Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife and causing businesses to move in to South Dakota and move out of Michigan and New Jersey and California? I mean, you got a migration. People are leaving California, New Jersey, and Michigan. They're getting in their cars and just packing up and leaving. And those states are getting poorer and poorer with higher and higher taxes, poorer and poorer business climates, and people moving out, which makes it worse for the people that stay. And the people that are leaving are going to places like South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Mississippi, Alabama. Why are they moving to those states? Well, listen to this. Now, the southern states still tend to be above the median. The conventional wisdom is that the South is much more pro-business in its government policies than it really turns out when you look at it. The index's author said, instead, the report found that many upper Midwest states are making the largest strides toward increasing economic freedom, attracting an index and an influx of capital, people, and businesses. And he uses the example of South Dakota. He says, for example, South Dakota, which doesn't tax corporate or personal income, they don't tax personal property, business inventories, or inheritances. They jumped 14 spots since 2004 when the index was last published. The state has the second most business-friendly tax climate, according to the Tax Foundation's 2009 Business Tax Climate Index. South Dakota, is a perfect example that other states can focus on and learn from, McQuillan said. And other states can learn how to structure a tax code that's very business-friendly and that encourages businesses and new people to move in. The state is becoming a magnet for technology firms and small manufacturing businesses, McQuillan said. Now, while other states in the region still rank behind many southern states, they're quickly catching up. Wisconsin, for example, trailed Virginia, Georgia, Arkansas, Alabama, and South Carolina in this latest index. But the Badger state's leap of 20 places from its spot in the previous index was the largest jump in the nation. Minnesota and Illinois jumped 18 and 19 places, respectively. But even the states making strides in the overall amount of economic freedom enjoyed by their citizens trail far behind in some sectors in the index. For example, while Wisconsin ranks ninth in the government size sector, only one state ranked lower in the fiscal sector. Still, what's happening in the upper Midwest is nothing short of an economic freedom renaissance, spurred largely by the pressure that one state's fiscal reforms puts on neighboring states to improve or lose people and capital, McQuillan said. Now, McQuillan points to Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty's effort to improve the business climate in his state. He's putting pressure on other states to follow along or be left in the dust. And McQuillan said it's a good kind of competitive environment. Now remember, South Dakota is a perfect example that other states can focus on and learn from. And other states can learn how to structure their tax code to be just as business friendly and encourage businesses and new people to move into their states. Now there's a migration gap. Let's take a look at migration here. One of the exceptions to this economic resurgence in the region is Michigan. Now, Michigan ranked 34th in the latest Economic Freedom Index. They're down 7 spots from its place in the 2004 edition. Michigan trails only Rhode Island in outbound migration, according to Lawrence Lefebvre, fiscal policy director of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, a think tank based in Michigan. Migration rates are a function of relative economic opportunity, Lefebvre said. So why would people leave behind everything they know and go and spend a fortune moving to a location that has equal, if not fewer, opportunities than the state where they currently reside? And it's not only a financial move, it's also a psychological move. They have to part with their culture, all of their friends and relatives. Now, the economically freest states are growing much faster than those with the least freedom, the study notes. Let me pause right there. Now, that's got a mouthful. The states that have the most economic freedom are growing faster than the states with the least economic freedom. Now, I didn't know that they had a ranking. I didn't know, for instance, that Rhode Island has the least business-friendly, highest taxes, and the poorest economy in the nation. I didn't know that until I read this Heartland Institute paper. They also have the highest unemployment in the nation. See, I used to think that belonged to Arkansas. No, not anymore. See, a lot of states woke up to the fact that their economic growth was stifled by their tax policies. And people are poor because the government policies make the poverty. That's why people want to leave where they live and come to the United States, because the United States still has the best overall economic policy for the lowest of the low, that is, the Joe Sixpack workers in the world. It's no wonder the Mexicans want to get the hell out of Mexico. Mexico is so repressive. It is so business unfriendly. Oh, it's friendly to Bank of America and Halliburton and KBR and AT&T, but it's not friendly to the small business, which is where most people make their money, make their living. If they're not actually operating the small business themselves, then they're employing people in those small businesses, and that's where most of the employment is. So what happens here is people leave. Now, let's take a look at George Gordon. I used to run a company, remember, a company, with 30 employees and produced $100,000 a month or about $1 million a year. And one day I said, enough, enough already. And I closed it down and I left Idaho. I packed up and left. I voted with my feet and got the hell out of there. When government harasses you, when government gets on your back, when government taxes and takes from you, you know, if there's any opportunity, if there's any way that you can escape the pain, the suffering, and the anguish, you're going to do it. I mean, hell, you know, if somebody's beating up on you and drawing blood, you're going to do everything you can to get the hell out of there. Get away from this guy. He's hurting me. Just common sense. You don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out. So if you want to know why people are leaving New Jersey, California, and Rhode Island, it's because of their tax policies. It's probably not the only reason, but it's a big one. Now, California is facing a $42 billion budget deficit. Well, yeah. And they got guys like George Gordon who used to live in California. I didn't like the business climate in California, and I left and moved to Idaho. Then I found out Idaho had a bad business climate, at least for me, and so I got the hell out of Idaho and I came to Missouri. So far, I'm not complaining about Missouri. So far. I don't know where we rank on the index here. But I want to point out that I'm a producer. And if you want me, then you want my business. Just the other day, I was talking to a lady down the road. Now, I run a school here, see? I run a school here, and students come from all over the country. They come from every state in the union and from around the world. They come to school here in this little town called Isabella, Missouri, not even incorporated. Small school. I mean, you know, we're not the University of Missouri, but their students come here. And the motels around this lake, I'm on a lake here called Lake Bull Shoals, and we're chit-chatting a little bit, and there's a lady down here runs a little motel, and she said, if it weren't for your school, we would have gone broke. I didn't know that. She said, especially in the winter months, when we don't have tourists, which is a good point, because, see, this is a tourist area. People come here and go fishing in this lake. Well, they don't fish in January, February, and March. So in the winter months, they don't have any income coming in. They don't have customers. They don't have tourists. But they have my students, see? And so she was talking to us, and she said, if it weren't for your school, we would have gone broke. We'd have gone bankrupt. So the restaurants around here, you know, when a student comes here, he has to eat, doesn't he? So he goes to the restaurants. And then at night after school, maybe he goes down to Mountain Home and he spends some money down at Mountain Home at Walmart, or he goes around to the restaurants, or he goes to the laundromat to wash his clothes, or he fills up his car with gasoline. All of that's money that is brought into this little town, this county, Ozark County, by the operation of this school. Now, the business climate here isn't bad. See, I'm not being hassled by my government. If the government gets on me and starts hassling me and raising hell with me and so on, I'll get discouraged, and I'll pack up, and I'll move. I'll be looking for some place that they're not going to bother me. Meanwhile, all of these businesses around me that benefit from these tourists that I bring here because of the operation of my school, those businesses pay taxes here. And that's what supports the local government. It's the dollars that are circulating around. Now, the other day I got a call from, I think it was Carnival Cruises, or it could have been Princess, but it was in Miami anyway. And they said, hey, come on down here and spend money and go on a Carnival cruise and have a good time. And I didn't do it. It's not because I don't have the money and I don't have the desire. It's that the government has put up a big roadblock. You see, If I want to go down to Miami, the logical thing to do would be to fly. So that means I got to go to the airport. Now, the airport is not a friendly place anymore. This is not the place to go fly the friendly skies of United. There's going to be long delays. They're going to charge me $15 to load my suitcase in and haul it down there for me. They're not going to give me peanuts and free drinks. They're not going to give me a meal on the flight. They're going to charge me an arm and a leg. Then they're going to make me undress and put me through security. And I look at that and I say, hell, I don't want to go to Miami. It isn't that I don't have the money and I don't have the desire. I don't want to be subjected to those kinds of indignities, that kind of inconvenience. And so I said, to hell with them. Now look at the repercussions. The people that run that cruise line down there, they need my business along with yours and everybody else's. And there are people, you know, the maids and the bartenders that work on those ships and the airline pilots and the stewardesses, you know, that could use my business. The airlines could probably use my business. But they're not business friendly. And so I don't do business with them. Now, I'm still spending money, but I'm not spending it on Carnival. I'm not spending it on the airlines. In fact, I convert it into gold and go bury it in a hole in the ground someplace. And it Now, my government wants me to get out there and spend, but they create an environment that is hostile to my spending, hostile to my business. And I say, well, hell, I'm not going to go do that. Picture this. Let's suppose you went into Walmart. You walk in the door and some surly guy comes up, slaps you across the face and says, what in the hell are you doing in here? Would you go back? That's what they do in the airports. Some surly guy comes over, strips you down, looks up your hind end, and he treats you rudely. Why in the hell would you want to go back? I mean, come on, guys, let's wake up and smell the coffee here, shall we? Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. But these endorsements and recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should all keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. However, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, remember, they're mine and they're mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So don't blame them, blame me. And if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the big sell. We're oftentimes sold things that we don't need, can't use, shouldn't have, and probably don't even want. But we buy them because there's peer pressure. We buy them because the government tells us it's good for us. Or we buy it because we see it on television, it's advertised, and they keep telling us over and over again how good this is. Now, after you've bought some of this crap for a while, and you find out that it isn't what it's all cracked up to be, then pretty soon you wake up to reality based upon your own personal experience. But wouldn't it be a lot better if we could learn from the experience of others first, so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel? Now, going back here, the upper Midwest is enjoying sudden renaissance of economic freedom, and there's a migration gap. There are people that are actually leaving states, like Rhode Island and Michigan. And why are they leaving? Well, they're leaving because it has a bad economic climate. You know, if you're living in Detroit and you're unemployed, that's not a good economic climate. If you're living in Austin, Texas, I have a student down in Austin, and the county government down there, he's in the apartment rental business, and they doubled his property taxes. They doubled them. And he went down and he said, well, you know, I can't afford to pay this and blah, blah, blah. And they just said, well, if you don't pay it, then we'll just take your property away from you and sell it on the courthouse steps. How do you like that? Now, that's not a friendly business climate. Now, what will happen is the government or the economy will ruin this guy, and they'll put him out of business, and he'll leave Austin. I mean, after he's had a bad experience in Austin, Texas, he's going to leave there. Now, the public officials in Austin say, well, to hell with them. We don't care. That's what they said down in Zimbabwe, and then they run the country into the ground. And in every country where this goes on, you know, people vote with their feet and they leave. That's why people are leaving Mexico. That's why people want to get the hell out of Guatemala and half the countries in South America, because of the bad economic climate. Now, here in the United States, we're creating bad economic climates, and so people are going to migrate to where it's better. I left California because it had a bad economic climate. And I left Idaho because it had a bad economic climate. And I want to tell you that where I'm at, I'm happy as a clam at high tide. I'm not complaining about the taxes here and so on. I live in a county with no building permits, if you can believe that. Yeah, no, I can go out here and I can build, and I don't have any hassle from the county. And I build. And every time I build something out here, it employs people. The guys down here at the building materials store, they love me. Every time I walk in there, I'm spending money. They love it. And I love it because I don't have the hassle of people coming out here and raising hell with me and threatening me with fines and one thing and another. So the building climate is so good here. I just love it. And so I was in California. Hell, you couldn't build an outhouse in California. They don't allow it. And if you did, you'd have to have an environmental impact statement before you can start construction. Hell, I can build an outhouse here and nobody cares. They laugh at you and say, what do you want that for? So the moral to the story is that government creates their own problems. California has a problem. They've created it themselves. And I'm not going to go back to California. People who live out there, you probably love it. Stay right there, pay your taxes, and suffer. And I tested it, I didn't like it, and I got the hell out. Now, it's a benefit, though, to the people around me. And all of the people that are around me over here where I'm spending money, see, they need that money. That's what makes business work. That's what makes my business work. It's customers spending their money with me, and I spend that money with others. And that money circulating around over here is what makes the thing work. Now, if government gets in and takes too much, if they become too oppressive, then it disrupts, it interferes with this business cycle. Let me show you how this works. Now, remember, Michigan trails only Rhode Island in outbound migration, according to Michael LaFave, or Lefebvre, fiscal policy director of the Mackinac Center for Policy or Public Policy, a think tank based in Michigan. So Michigan and Rhode Island have the highest rates of migration. People are leaving those states and they're going someplace else. And where are they going? They're going to places like Wisconsin and South Dakota. Why? Well, because South Dakota doesn't have any income tax. South Dakota doesn't have a business tax. They don't have an inventory tax. And because those are government agencies. Every time you put on one of these taxes, you got to have a tax policeman coming around raising hell with you. If you got a personal property tax, you got to have a personal property tax policeman coming out and raising hell with you. It's economic disaster. It's just economic death. That's what it boils down to. Now, why would people leave behind everything they know and go and spend a fortune moving? The economy, economically freest states, are growing much faster than those with the least freedom, the study notes, according to the McQuillan Index. Net in-migration for the 20 economically freest states between 2003 and 2007 was 27.36 people per thousand. All right, so now you take the states that have the freest economies, and for every 1,000 people that live in the state, you got 27 people moving in. How do you like that? That's the migration rates were only 1.17 people per 1,000 in the most economically oppressed states. Thus, Americans are voting with their feet, as economist Charles Tybout described it. So in Michigan, it's the people are increasing in their economy at the rate of one person per 1,000, and they're increasing at the rate of 27 people per 1,000 in South Dakota. Now, South Dakota doesn't have a whole lot of people to start with. And I wouldn't have thought. I've been through there a time or two, and I didn't think much of South Dakota. But evidently, they have changed their policies, changed their government taxation to such a degree that it's now beneficial. Well, hell, you know, when people move in, that's 27 more people over there that are going to be buying gasoline down at the gas station. 27 people are moving in there that are working and producing and doing something that other people want. And that's where the real economy is. It's real people that are producing real goods and services. Now, here's what happens. It's debilitating for government to hire some secretary, stick her in a room, and then pay her $30,000 a year to move papers back and forth. Because, see, you and I, the guys that are putting the roofs on the houses and plumbing the houses and doing the real physical work, driving the trucks, delivering the goods and the services and so on, we have to support that girl. And what is she doing for us? Moving paper around. Getting her ass pinched over at the water cooler. What in the hell does that do for you and me? See where we're going with this? Now, the outfit that reports on this is called the Heartland Institute. So I'm going to give you their name and number here so you can get a copy of this. If nothing else, you know, tell them send me one copy so that I can see if this guy Gordon's lying to me. Heartland. H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D. Heartland Institute. Now, they're up in Chicago, Illinois. And they got a website. It's heartland.com. No, excuse me, heartland.org. O-R-G, not com. It's org. www.heartland.org. They also have a phone number up there. It's 312-377-4000. If you get your pen and paper out there, you get 312-377-4000, $36 a year, 10 issues. Now, the political consequences they point out are this. Listen to this. Low migration rates can eventually lead to a reduction in the number of representatives the state sends to Congress, which can then translate into a loss of power and federal dollars, like California, which ranked number 49 in McQuillan's report. Michigan is poised to lose a seat in Congress after the next census. And we already get back less money from the federal government than we send in, LaFave said. Now, losing a congressional seat will mean less power, and the likelihood that we will have less money in our roads or for our roads and in our hands. Now, here's the guide for recovery. However, McQuillan notes the research provided by the index can be a guide for recovery even in Michigan. If Michigan improved its economic freedom by just one slot, if it went from number 43 up to number 42, that would translate into a net increase of 10,000 people in the state. Now, that's an influx of badly needed consumers, investors, workers, and entrepreneurs. And I want to tell you that when I left Idaho, it's a net loss for Idaho. In fact, I was through Boise, Idaho not too long ago, and the old factory at 412 South 9th Street was still empty after all these years. Still empty. And the 30 people that were working in there, I guess they're working someplace else, aren't they? And that's just one more business that's gone, evaporated. I won't do that anymore. And it's because of bad government tax policy. Now, I can tell you that from personal experience. And what we're seeing here now is the results of this bad economic and bad tax policy that's been going on here in the United States now for about 75 years. Now, let me flip over the page here. There's a story in here that's a corollary to this. New Jersey has the nation's worst business tax climate. New Jersey. Now, the Tax Foundation's 2009 State Business Tax Climate Index, the sixth annual report ranking the 50 states on the business friendliness of their tax codes, finds New Jersey has the worst business tax climate in the nation for the second year in a row. The organization released the index in October in Trenton, New Jersey, to highlight the Garden State's earning the worst overall score. All right, now let's pause here for a moment. I don't know if you've been watching TV, but New Jersey's got some bad towns in it, bad places. Now, when a guy like George Gordon pulls up stakes and leaves, I'm the guy with money. I'm the guy with investment capital. I'm the guy that employs people. The 30 people that were working for me are down at the bottom of the pond. They're bottom feeders. They don't have the economic resources to just pull out and leave. So what happens is when you have bad tax policy, you leave all of the bottom feeders there, feeding off of the fewer and fewer entrepreneurs that they need to support them. The migration out of California isn't the welfare mothers. It isn't the poor people, the immigrants and migrants. It isn't all of those workers there that are working for minimum wage. It's the capital. It's the businessmen and the businesswomen. It's the people that have the money. And they leave and they go to places, you know, like Colorado. That's a big one. Or Montana. That's another big one. They get the hell out of a place, you know, like Los Angeles, California, and they take their money and everything that they've got with them, and they migrate, and they go to Colorado. That's good for Colorado. Now, the people up in Colorado need to wake up to reality. Don't do like California. Now, we got a problem here. They call them outsiders here where I'm at. God, they hate them. The reason that we don't have building permits here is because the locals here don't want that kind of regulation. What's the first thing that a Californian wants when he moves to Ozark County? Where in the hell is your zoning and building department? How in the hell can you people live without zoning and planning? And they want to bring the same kind of insane policies that caused them to leave California to start with, and they want to implement them here in Ozark County. They want to bring the tyranny with them. So if you want to know why they don't like outsiders here in the Ozarks, it's because the problems that you people are fleeing from, you're all practicing communists and you want to bring your damn communism down here and impose it upon us. That's why you're not welcome here. So here's New Jersey. See, New Jersey, number 50, it has the nation's worst business tax climate. So the people leave New Jersey who have the money, the capital, and the resources to employ the poor people who live there. And they leave the poor people right where they're at, in Camden, New Jersey, or Trenton, or wherever. You know, those people don't migrate out of there. They don't have the resources to escape the poverty that they're in. But the people that do have it leave, and I'm one of them. You want to attract people like me. You want more people like me to set up businesses and to generate trade, commerce, business, and industry. And that's what they've done up in South Dakota. And they've got the exact opposite policy in Michigan and in New Jersey. And so the purpose here of the Heartland Institute here is to wake up these legislators in Michigan and New Jersey. Hey, wake up. Pay attention here. Instead of enacting laws with a penal clause in them that drives business away and drives your tax base away from you, why don't you encourage those people to come in and move into your state and invest in your state and create trade, commerce, business, and industry? If you want to know why China is such an economic powerhouse, they don't have all of the bureaucratic regulations that you have here in the United States. And before we had the bureaucratic regulation in the United States, we were the economic powerhouse of the world. So if you want to destroy your economic base, if you want to destroy your industry, then you need more homeland securities. You need more OSHAs. You need more zoning and planning and building departments. I mean, load up with more and more regulation, bureaucracy, and raise your taxes. That'll drive your business to China. Now, if you want to get your business from China, then you've got to emulate that winning business strategy that you see emulated here at Walmart. Walmart has exactly the opposite business strategy of United Airlines. United Airlines is busily driving their customers away by being rude, obnoxious, by overcharging and underperforming, and subjecting their customers to every kind of indignity in their airports. And then here's the airline industry complaining about, oh my God, woe is us. We just don't know how we're going to make it. We're going to have to charge you $15 to move your bag. Yeah, you charge me $15 to move my bag, you can kiss my business goodbye forever. What the hell are you talking about, you fools? You blind, you nitwits? The reason I shop at Walmart is I walk in the door. I often said, you know, if the people at Kmart wanted to turn the Kmart company around, they ought to send somebody over to Walmart and watch and see what the hell they're doing over there. I can tell you that as a customer, I stay away from Kmart. They're so damn rude and obnoxious, you can't find a Kmart employee to ask them where something's at. You can't find anything in a Kmart store. And if you can, write it down in a hurry, because you'll never find it twice. And then they're rude, nasty, sullen. I walk into the Walmart store, and they got a guy there at the store. He says, "Welcome to Walmart. We're glad to have you." He pushes a basket over to me. Makes me feel welcome. I drive around in the Walmart store. I can't find something. There's somebody there. Say, "Hey, you, can you tell me where to go?" Yeah. In fact, 90% of the time, the guy will lead you. At least in our local Walmart store, they do. Now, I was in one down Mississippi, and I thought, if Walmart wants to follow the Kmart lead over there, they can go the same way Kmart's going broke. But over here in our local store, the guy will just follow me. And he'll walk a half a mile, you know, through the store and take you right to the battery department, right to the battery chargers, right to the hardware, whatever the hell you want, and take you right over there. Want your business? And that's why Walmart is so damn successful. They got a better business model. They're there to serve their customers. Their customers feel good about it, and they want to come back. Take a look at the rest of these businesses complaining over here. The rest of you businesses, wake up. Smell the coffee. Walmart's got a better business model. Learn how to compete. Going on, lawmakers have control. The index ratings are based on tax rates and statutes, not tax collections. Everything rated is directly under legislative control, and legislatures are fully empowered to determine their own scores. The index also shows what legislative changes would improve state standing and by how much. In addition, the index shows in real time when states improve or worsen their tax climates. The Tax Foundation maintains the index to show legislatures and legislators what they have to do in order to improve their state's tax structure and tax codes to increase their appeal to business. So I can only assume that they don't want my business. This is the Heartland Institute. Now, these people are missionaries. They got a goal. They want to take this to your state legislature and say, hey, listen, you want to make California more business-friendly? Arnie, pay attention here. Subscribe to the Heartland Institute Tax and Budget News. And then let's start implementing some of these changes over here. We want to increase the tax base. We want more tax revenue going to Sacramento. How do you do that? As a businessman, I don't care how much tax the state collects. I just want you guys to get off my backs over here and stop this regressive tax policy. Let's stimulate business. You know, if you're taxing 10%. This is what God's tax is, 10%. It's a very low tax. But it's a 10% tax on all of your increase. 10% tax on everything. It's broad-based. It's not very high, but it's broad-based. Applies to everybody. It applies to everything, but it's a very low tax, broad-based. It doesn't harm business. It stimulates business. And that's where you get your money. Now, as soon as you start raising these taxes, I saw the president here the other day, I think I reported this to you, raised the cigarette tax by a dollar a pack to fund some project that he's got over here. Hell, that's regressive. That isn't gonna increase revenue. The smokers that now have to pay that extra dollar a pack, many of those smokers are going to be driven to the mafia. It's going to increase the revenue for the mafia. It's not going to increase the revenue for the federal government. So, I don't smoke anymore, but I'm going to tell you this. If I did smoke and you raised my tax by a dollar, I'd be looking for another source. And as soon as somebody provides it, and there will be somebody there, there's always a competitor. And by the way, I mentioned this the other day. Did you know that drugs, legal drugs, marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, are twice as expensive at your Rexall store than they are down here on the street corner? And that's why illegal drugs flourish in America. They flourish because of government regulation. You have regulated the product until you've driven it underground and made it so profitable that it thrives in the underground black market. In the free economy, it just thrives. It's the biggest business in America. And the rest of business languishes because it is being regressively taxed. Hey, I'm running out of time here, kids. We've got to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our webpage at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.